In the news now, there's a lot of taking down of monuments, but the stories of taking down of monuments is not a very new thing. In 410 AD, the Visigoths sacked Rome, and here I believe in this Renaissance painting, in the Renaissance they were perfecting the art of painting the human body, as you can see. Here you have a depiction of taking down a statue of Caesar. Yeah, you can pull that fan in, Pete, and shut that door. It'll probably help with some of the sound. The Visigoths, as we often hear them displayed as barbarians, they were actually Christians, but they were Arian Christians, so St. Augustine didn't particularly like their theology. But the sack of Rome and the disturbance it caused in the whole Roman world prompted St. Augustine to read what was one of the most formative books in the history of Christianity, The City of God. The Visigoths were also a Germanic tribe. They came from Northern Europe and they had inhabited a region of what today we call France. Gaul, as it was called by the Romans, was Northern Italy, Switzerland, France. And the Visigoths were from that region, and through some of the political machinations, they had decided enough was enough, and so they stormed and pillaged Rome. They left the Christian churches alone, and even pagans fled to the Christian churches for sanctuary, because they would only sack the pagan temples and the houses of the pagan nobility. In some ways, this was a bit of a comeuppance, because in 58 BC, Julius Caesar began his campaign in Gaul. Now, Julius Caesar, in order to secure the power that he was seeking, had taken on tremendous debt. And so, as has happened many times in history, he contrived a provocation with the people of Gaul, who weren't one people but whole groups of people, and began a campaign. And he himself wrote the book describing the campaign, and in some ways that book was itself a campaign document, more in terms of his celebrity and his status. He bragged about the fact that he killed at least 1 million in Gaul in his political campaign and took another 1 million+ as slaves. You say, well, how does a war pay the bills? Well, when you're sacking and killing, and especially when you're enslaving, you can earn a lot of money. Slavery has been nearly as universal a human institution as marriage and prostitution. It was estimated that in the Roman Empire, nearly half of the people were slaves. You fell into slavery, and now notice the words, it's sort of like falling into a pit. You fell into slavery usually in one of two ways. Either you got yourself too deeply into debt and would have to become someone's slave, or your city or nation or tribe lost a war. And basically the deal was, if you lost the war, the prevailing army would come and say, look, because you've lost the war, it's well within our rights to kill you all, so we'll give you a deal. Either we will kill you, or you will become a slave. And if, in fact, you do become a slave, you will lose all your human rights. The marriages that you are in will be severed. The debts that you all have will be gone. In a sense, what slavery was, especially in Roman law, was itself a sentence of death. You were a non-person. If you fell into slavery and then, in fact, were able to climb out of slavery again and you wanted to pick up in your marriage, you would actually have to remarry your spouse because you passed from death back into life again. In a very interesting book called Debt the First 5,000 Years, the author goes quite a bit into the roots of slavery for nearly all of human institutions today. And many would have noted that, how on earth, if slavery was so formative in human history, how did it pass out of legality? And the author notes that, in fact, this happened a number of times throughout human history. One of the times it happened was the fall of Rome, the rise of Christianity, and the rise of the medieval era. In the colonial era, in some ways, it was reinstituted. But then, of course, in the middle modern period, which is the abolition that most of us know of, it passed out of custom again. Many might notice that if you look at CNN or, in fact, other places, just this morning I saw in my news feed talk about the fact that currently in China, certain minority ethnic groups are virtually enslaved by the Chinese during the COVID epidemic to keep some of their industry going. The Chinese, of course, have had a practice of rather enslaving industrial practices. At one point at Foxconn, people disliked the working conditions in the factory so much they were throwing themselves off the roof of the factories. And so Foxconn decided, well, we can't have that. So instead of improving workers' conditions, they put up nets so you couldn't even kill yourself out of your miserable factory job. Many people have asked the question, has slavery really gone away? Or have economic conditions changed to the degree that it's simply become unprofitable? In the early days of the American nation, in fact, although many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were themselves slave owners, many imagined that slavery was going to go away because it was increasingly economically unprofitable. And as you likely learned in history class when you were in junior high or high school, with the invention of the cotton gin, slavery once again in the American South became profitable for the manufacture of cotton. But if you were to ask yourself today, would you like to have a slave? Would it be economic profitable? You might consider the following. In today's terms, in the antebellum South, a slavery costs something like a moderate car, maybe $40,000. If you were opening a burger joint and you wanted labor, would it be more practical to buy a slave or rent labor? Now, if you bought a slave, how would you have to care for that slave? Well, you would need food, clothing, shelter, health care, because you don't want your slave breaking down on the job, and you would also have to pay for escape prevention. Most of us today would rather rent our human beings because it's cheaper and easier. We call that giving them a job. And part of the reason for that is less financial responsibility. And even before the Civil War in North America, there was a lot of debate about slavery versus wage labor, because many of the industrialists up north, people would come in, they'd pay for the hour. If they were hurt or ill, well, you lose your job. If you had a slave, well, you had capital on the line. In fact, in California during the 49ers, part of the reason California was a free state was that many of the people who came from northern counties resented people coming from southern slave states bringing their slaves. They saw this as an unfair advantage, so they made sure that California was a free state. The fact about slavery is that owning a human being requires a system of outrageous brutality and barbarity. And this has been true throughout the history of slavery among human beings. This was, in fact, noted and highlighted by the abolitionist book Uncle Tom's Cabin, that sort of turned the light on to people in northern states about the conditions of slaves in the southern states. You have to intimidate and brutalize and terrorize your slave. You can beat but not kill, because after all, if you kill your slave, you're out of your money. Now, in the midst of this world, having the barbarians go through Rome, Augustine wrote his majestic work, The City of God, in which he contrasted two human cities. He said there's the city of God and the city of man, or the city of humanity. And he said you can understand history by tracking these two cities and the ways that business is conducted in each. Actually, the title of the book was in Latin. It was Civitas. And Civitas, we often translate city, but it's also civilization. Because in many ways, civilization is deeply tied to the emergence of the city. We see that very clearly in the book of Genesis. In Genesis 4, Adam and Eve had two children, Cain and Abel. And as they are most often remembered, Cain and Abel, what happened? They both come with sacrifices. Abel's sacrifice is received. Cain's sacrifice is not met with as good a reception. Cain does not take this well, and instead of bringing his complaint to God, he kills his brother. God then shows up, asks him where his brother is. Cain very famously says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" The implicit answer is, well, you really are. And God curses Cain, and Cain says, "It's too much, I'll die." And so God says, "I won't take your life, I'll put a mark on you, and no one will touch you. Anyone who touches you will be avenged by me as God 7 times. And so Cain went from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain made love to his wife. Now we're using the NIV, and some of you might remember in the King James Version, the more specific translation was, Cain knew his wife. That's going to be important later in the sermon. And she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city. This is the first reference to a city in the Bible. And it was being undertaken by the hands of Cain, which were stained by the blood of his brother. And he named it after his son, Enoch. Lamech, one of Cain's descendants, is also famous. He had 2 wives, not one, so he was quite prosperous. One was named Adah, and the other Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal. Jabal was the father of those who lived in tents and raised livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of those who played string instruments and pipes. You can see the beginning of civilization, of technology, of all of the things that we do in this world that are worth doing and worth enjoying. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, "Listen to me, wives of Lamech." He must have had quite an ego speaking of himself in the third person. "Hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is venged by God 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. What is Lamech saying? Civilization is growing. Lamech's power is growing. If God only seeks revenge 7 times, I'm bigger and badder. Don't touch me." This is the way of the city of man. Some of you, in fact, when I posted my rough draft of this, mentioned Sargon of Akkad, and everybody thought I was referring to a political YouTuber. Actually, I was referring to the original Sargon of Akkad. Sargon of Akkad is known as the first emperor that we know of in human civilization. He conquered many of the Sumerian city-states and bonded them together as part of the first empire. This is some of the land where Abraham came from. And what you might notice in these stories is that we're framing Israel with the Fertile Crescent to the north and Egypt to the east. Now, the story goes that Sargon of Akkad, well, he was a man of interesting birth. And so there's a very famous legend about Sargon's birth that I'd like to read to you. And as I start reading to you, some of you will begin to hear bells. "Sargon, strong king, king of Akkad I am." Kind of sounds like Lamech. "My mother was a high priestess. My father, I do not know. My paternal kin inhabit the mountain regions. My city of birth was," the writing's a little low, a little small, "Azuparinu, which lies at the bank of the Euphrates. My mother, a high priestess," did I mention that before, "conceived me. In secret, she bore me. She placed me in a reed basket. With bitumen, she caulked my hatch. She abandoned me to the river, by which I could not escape. The river carried me along to Aki, the water drawer. It brought me. Aki, the water drawer, when immersing his bucket, lifted me up. Oops, a baby. Aki, the water drawer, raised me as his adopted son. And Sargon would be raised and would become a cupbearer to a strong man. And how did he become emperor? He killed his boss and took his place. And for almost all of human history, this is how power is acquired in the city of man. Now, we're beginning a series on the book of Exodus. And the book of Exodus begins where the book of Genesis leaves off. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Now, astute readers will recognize, especially if you're reading in Hebrew, this is an exact quotation from the beginning of the book of Genesis. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, Israel in Egypt has been fruitful and multiplied and has filled the land. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt, killing his predecessor. That's how the city of man works. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. They've already got immigration questions in Egypt. Too late to build a wall for Palestine. The Israelites are already multiplying in there. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Or worse, fight against us and take the country, because those who live by the rules of the city of man fear the rules of the city of man. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithon and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. It looks like a minor thing, because if you're going through a town, let's say driving up the valley, and you see these big granaries, you don't think of them as, let's say, Chinese sweatshops. You think of them as places of abundance where we secure our food. But the truth is, in the ancient world, these were seen as economic villains. Because, of course, when the harvest comes in, everyone has grain. Grain is cheap. Really savvy people built granaries. And governments and emperors would tax sometimes 85% of the grain. You complain about your taxes? What if your rate were 85%? They take 85% of the grain and they put them in the storehouses, and guess what? As the year went on, or maybe there was a bad season, food would get short, grain prices would go up. Guess who has all the grain? So in the ancient world, granaries were seen as tools of oppression. The Israelites had to build the weapons for their oppressors. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. Notice the repetition. The king of Egypt said to Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see a baby is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live. A little reverse patriarchy here. The midwives, however, feared God more than Pharaoh, quite obviously, and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the little boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? Now we wonder if they should have feared Pharaoh more than God. These midwives are awfully spunky, and the text is read to a rather comic fashion, because here you have Emperor of the world, God, man, Pharaoh, who is the conduit by which the power of the gods flow into Egypt through the Nile and through all the other aspects of the land. We'll get into that when we get into the plagues. But these midwives are spunky and they stand up to Pharaoh. Hebrew women are not like you flaccid Egyptian women who are lying around on your ivory beds. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. We're not to blame. So God was kind to the midwives and the people increased further still. You get this picture of more and more and more. And the more Pharaoh tries to resist, the worse Pharaoh is, the more oppressive he is, the stronger those underneath become. This is, in fact, a pattern you can see in history. Why do you lift weights? You oppress your muscles, and they become stronger. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Well, why would this be? Well, because lines are considered to go through the men. So if you get rid of all the men, all the women marry Egyptians, that way you assimilate the population. Why throw into the Nile? Well, the Nile is a god. It's sort of like an ordeal. Throw the baby into the Nile, and if the baby lives, it'll be a great baby. If the baby dies, oh well. Well, practice that 10 times. How many dead babies do you get? But now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Good thing Moses was a good-looking baby. But when she could not hide him any longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Does this sound familiar? This is like the Sargon story. Why would that be? She placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. So if the baby police come, you could say, I put the baby in the Nile. Didn't say anything about the basket, or actually the word that the Hebrew use here is ark, which is not a normal word for a basket. And so quite literally in Hebrew, the mother makes an ark and places the baby in the chaotic waters of the Nile so the baby will survive the storm. Very similar to, of course, Noah surviving the storm of the great flood. And so we have all of this elements of who is this boy going to be? Could this boy be a Sargon? Could this boy be the kind of boy that is thrown into the Nile and survives? Could this boy be a rescuer, a hero who will rise up and kill the king of Egypt and bring his people to justice? We will see. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. And she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her slave, her female slave, to get it. She's not going to go running through the weeds to get a basket. Go fetch me the basket. And she opened it and saw a baby, and he was crying. Amazingly few references to crying babies in the Bible. But here is one. And it's a little sign about, is Moses going to be Sargon? Will the people of God live by the rules of the city of man? And she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. This is one of the Hebrew babies. Well, supposed to throw him back in the river, right? You're the daughter of Pharaoh, after all, right? Well, then the sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go. Fine idea, she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. You get the comedy in this story? The more Pharaoh represses, the more he loses. And he's losing not to Sargon of Akkad. Who's he losing to? Midwives and a scofflaw Hebrew mom. So not only does the woman get to keep and raise her baby, she gets paid for it. This is UBI on a grand scale. Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And right there you can see the tensions. But weaning in the ancient world might have meant 4 or 5 years. In other words, little Moses is about ready to go to boarding school, and he will have the best boarding school in the ancient world, the court of Pharaoh himself. He will get the finest education available to anyone in that part of the ancient world. This little Hebrew boy. Wow, maybe he will be like Sargon. Maybe he'll be the cupbearer to Pharaoh. And maybe one night when Pharaoh drifts off to sleep, Moses will slit his throat. That's what Sargon would do. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, saying, "I drew him up out of the water." Now, it's an interesting thing because most scholars have noted Moses is actually an Egyptian word. And it's an Egyptian word that many pharaohs had in their name. Ramses, Thutmose, and it was always connected with one of the Egyptian gods. Well, that Egyptian god part is taken off only to leave Moses. Will he be Sargon of Levi? One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. And he likely remembered his mother saying, "You're going to be raised as an Egyptian. Pharaoh's daughter will name you, but you're not really an Egyptian. You're a Hebrew. Don't you forget." So all those years in school, he cultivated his imagination as a Hebrew. And now his moment has arrived. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Oh, the start of Moses' rise. Louis the 16th, some of you might not remember who Louis the 16th was. Louis the 14th, the Sun King. Louis the 16th had a very famous wife named Marie Antoinette, who had a very famous declaration about the people who didn't have enough bread. Well, let them eat cake. Louis the 16th made an interesting observation about revolutions to his friends. "Have these men studied in history of any people how revolutions commence and how they are carried out? How they are observed by what fatal chain of circumstances the wisest men are drawn far beyond the limits of moderation? And by what terrible impulses an enraged people is precipitated into excesses at the very thought of which they would have shuddered?" In other words, once you start a revolution, Louis the 16th's revolution, which would cost him his head, was one of the greatest proofs of this. You never know who it's going to kill. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. "Hey, wait a minute. We're brothers in solidarity under this slavery, under the cruel yoke of the Egyptians. We ought to be united against the foe." He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? You're an Egyptian. Aren't Egyptians evil? Why should we listen to you? Are you thinking of killing me like you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have been known. I didn't look around enough." Then Pharaoh heard of this, and he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. If you know any American history, you should know the name of John Brown. John Brown, fierce abolitionist, moved to Kansas, bloody Kansas, to kill those slave staters who were there. John Brown imagined that, well, if the slaves only had guns, they would kill their masters and rise up. So October 16, 1859, he and a group of abolitionists stormed the armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And a young officer in the Union Army named Robert E. Lee was dispatched to take back the armory. John Brown was a very zealous man, not a great planner. The slave uprising did not happen, and John Brown would hang from an American gallows. But Moses went to a well. And here's the funny thing about wells in the Bible. Wells in the Bible are sort of like proms for Marty McFly. This is where famous people find each other. Jacob got his wife. Jacob, always the weak one of the patriarchs. Abram's other servant found Isaac a wife at a well. Got Rebecca there. Jacob found Leah, or found Rachel, and eventually got Leah too, at the well. Jesus met a woman at the well. Didn't get married. Now, a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flocks. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today? My seven daughters, that water's heavy, and we only have stone jars." They added, "An Egyptian." Notice how Moses is identified. He's an Egyptian. "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." And Reuel, not one to pass up an opportunity, said, "Well, where is he?" He asked his daughters, "Why did you leave him there? It's a man. Dad got seven of you. We need someone of promise, someone of strength, someone who can do something. Foolish daughters, go bring him here." And of course they did, and he stayed with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. During those days, however, the king of Egypt died, and there was no liberator to hasten his death. And all the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. Later we'll discover they had even forgotten his name. God, it seems, opens poorly addressed prayer envelopes. Their cry for rescue came up to God, and God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. The people had forgotten the covenant, but God remembered. And God saw the people of Israel. Right there, that simple, just a few words in Hebrew. All of their suffering, all of their pain, all of the injustice, all that had happened, the world says nobody sees, nobody cares. God saw. And God knew. That's just what the Hebrew says. Remember Cain knowing his wife? God knew. It's not a, "Oh yeah, I know that." It's the kind of knowledge that gives birth to a son. It's the kind of knowledge that conceives a change in history. Now, the city of man goes round and round. Julius enslaves the descendants of the ancestors of the Visigoths. The Visigoths ride down and take down Caesar's statues. Barbarians pillage Rome. Sargon, cupbearer, slits the throat of the previous king. Moses murders. Moses is a murderer. The city of man is predictable, but our lives are short, and we forget. Even Louis XVI not necessarily known for his statecraft, given how it ends for him, even he knew the revolutions of the city of man. But God sees, and God knows. John Brown, who thought if he armed the slaves, they would rise up and be in solidarity, and just everything would go wonderful if once the slaves got power, hung from a gallows. But afterwards, they went through his things in the cell, and they found a note. And this note is often seen as a sort of prophecy of the American Civil War. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of the guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. John Brown himself was trying to prime the blood pump and get it going, but failed. If you want a good biography of him, I can recommend Midnight Rising. Guilt is purged away with blood. Sacrifices make that clear. But the blood of mere men, it seems, do not suffice to stop the cycle. We just keep killing each other because we just say, I've gotten the short end of the stick. I have to do justice. I have to tear them down. When I'm king, I'll do what's right. But someone coming up behind says, no, you're not doing what's right. When I'm king, I'll do what's right. And round and round and round we go. Cain, the first of the city of men, laid its foundations with hands bloodied by his brother. The book of Hebrews says this, but you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God. It's the God who sees and the God who hears. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. Every time we do communion, what do I tell you? This is a new covenant, Jesus says, in my blood. The covenant of blood, animal after animal after animal, doesn't end the cycle. My blood does. To Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel, which cried out for vengeance on his brother. We've just begun to get into the book of Exodus, and what we will see. We will see what God will do. He sees, he knows, soon he will act. He's already actually been acting through the multiplication. We will see a revolutionary redeemer who, in fact, in some ways, undoes revolution itself. We will see an empire undone and a people freed from external bondage, and they will be filled with joy at the death of their enemies. But then they will learn that the beginnings of freedom are far more than losing an oppressor. They will see the beginnings of their freedom from a deeper bondage that binds both slave owner and slave. Let's pray. Lord, we have all these ideas how to fix the world. We can point to the evil people of our age, whether they be Hitler or Stalin or Mao or Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Jeff Bezos. We've always got someone to point to. But you, Lord, watch our silly little circles. And watch us bloody our hands with the blood of those we declare as tyrants, only to notice that bloodied hands bloody themselves to keep themselves in power. And you take a foot into history, and you allow your own son to be bloodied for those with bloody hands. Help us, Lord, to see. Help us, Lord, to know. Help us, Lord, to to learn to forgive. And help us, Lord, to follow your Son. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen.